The story of a real-life Titan beset by the vicissitudes of fate concerns that of Reuben Hurricane Carter, a boxer wrongly convicted for murder. When Carter was convicted, his case was the subject of countless newspaper articles and a famous song by Bob Dylan. But dramatic reversals of fortune can prove to be a slippery subject for Midwinter's Tale. Critics have praised the film's portrayal of Carter's suffering and the performance by Denzel Washington. Others say Carter is victimized again by the story's dramatization. From New York, John Kalish reports.
On June 16, 1966, three white people in a Paterson, New Jersey bar were gunned down by two black men. Reuben Carter and a young man named John Artis were questioned by police that night because their car matched the getaway vehicle. 3.5 months later, they were indicted for the triple murders. At the trial, the prosecution offered no motive for the killings. Nevertheless, in May of 1967, Carter and Artis were convicted, based primarily on the testimony of two burglars who were caught near the bar and claimed they saw Artis and Carter fleeing the scene.
There's no doubt in my mind that he was framed or falsely imprisoned. That's unquestionable. He certainly spent 19 years in prison as a wrong man.
In 1974, Selwyn Rabb wrote a front-page article for the New York Times in which the prosecution's key witnesses recanted their stories. Overnight, Carter became a cause célèbre, and new lawyers volunteered to take his case.
There was an appeal to reverse the first conviction on the basis of the recantations, and the verdicts were overturned, and it led to the second trial.
That was in 1976. Prosecutors finally introduced a motive. They charged that the triple murders came in retaliation for the killing of a black bar owner by a white man. The jury accepted the racial revenge theory, and Carter and Artis were convicted a second time. John Artis was paroled 5 years later after serving a total of 15 years. Reuben Carter remained in jail. He appealed numerous times in state court until his lawyers finally appealed to federal court in a case that became a benchmark of habeas corpus law. In November of 1985, federal Judge H. Lee Sarakin overturned the second convictions on the grounds that the prosecution had withheld evidence and that its racial revenge theory had fatally infected the jury. John Artis' lawyer, Lou Steele, spoke to reporters outside the federal courthouse in Newark immediately after the ruling.
What the judge said today is you can't dredge up that old junk and try to use that to prejudice the press, to prejudice the people. And he said that it's time for that to come to a stop. And that was about as important as anything that happened in that courtroom today.
Steele's client, John Artis, is now a social worker in Norfolk, Virginia. Reuben Carter has lived in Canada since 1988. He's now 63 years old and is not bitter about what's happened to him.
After spending 20 years in prison, almost being executed for something that I not only could not do, but would not do, and did not do, struggling constantly with mindless, knuckleheaded human beings, for me to be alive today, for me to be anywhere today, is a miracle. It is miraculous. And I would not soil that miracle for 1 second by being angry or bitter or contumacious or any of those other things. That would be a sacrilege.
Carter's supporters are happy he's finally getting so much positive recognition, with a screening of the hurricane at the White House, the publication of a new biography, and the reprinting of The 16th Round, his autobiography. It was that book that brought Carter to the attention of a black Brooklyn teenager who had been taken in by a white Canadian commune. Lesra Martin and the Canadians got involved in the legal crusade to free Hurricane Carter. In the film, Martin, portrayed by Vassellis Shannon, visits Carter in prison.
Mr. Carter? Reuben Hurricane Carter, that you?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, you don't look like your pictures. I thought you'd be bigger.
Yeah, I'm bigger than you. But don't tell anybody, okay?
All right.
Okay, sit down.
Yeah, this is some place, man.
No, it's not. This is no place. Not for a human being. No,
Don't ever get used to a place like this, Lazarus. You got a lot of guts, kid. Takes a lot of courage to come all the way down here by yourself. If I'm impressed.
The film portrays the Canadian group as key to unearthing new evidence that helps exonerate Carter. That's just one of the dramatic liberties that's annoyed those who were there. They argue the movie sanitizes Carter's personal history, which included a 4-year prison stint for muggings. They also say the movie fails to make an important point, that part of the criminal justice system in New Jersey conspire to convict two innocent men. Instead, as former New York Times reporter Selwyn Rabb says, the film lays the blame on a single racist cop.
There wasn't just one heavy. There were an important network of people who covered up, who concealed, who suppressed. And that's the harrowing part of that story, which is totally lost in the film, is that it was a system, not just one individual.
This is not a docudrama we're making. We're trying to make a motion picture that will involve people and not bore them with all kinds of redundant testimony.
The Hurricanes director, Norman Jewison, concedes that he personified the criminal justice system in one rogue cop, but says casting all of the police, prosecutors, and judges in the case would have made the story unwieldy.
I'm pretty secure in the fact that most of what's on the screen is real and true and authentic. But I must confess there is a lot that isn't on the screen because, my God, to do that, I would have to make a 6-hour film.
The movie all but ignores Hurricane Carter's co-defendant, John Artis, and completely eliminates Fred Hogan, an investigator for the New Jersey Public Defender's Office who dug up critical evidence, as well as Richard Solomon, a freelance writer who started a defense committee for the imprisoned boxer. While Selwyn Rabb thinks The Hurricane is a good movie and understands the filmmaker's need to dramatize events, he still thinks the real story is more compelling.
When you view the film, the first half of it is pretty exciting because there's a lot of good elements. You've got fight scenes. You've got imprisonment. You've got a murder, a triple murder. But the producers and the director may have been stuck after the first half to say, how do we pep up the remainder of the film? The producer told me they didn't want to just drag out courtroom scenes, which, of course, is always a problem when you're dealing with a criminal case. So by bringing in the Canadians and by having them act as sleuths, as daring-do detectives, they thought they were creating more excitement and giving some lift to the second half of the film. But as history goes, it's bunk.
For his part, Reuben Carter is quite happy with the movie. He's been involved from the very beginning as an advisor, and though he had no written contract, he says he had a verbal agreement with the producers that gave him veto power over anything he didn't like.
I had a deal with the president of Beacon Communications, Army Bernstein, and that was maintained, and there's nothing in the movie that I object to.
Carter says the most important thing is that the film presents a positive portrayal of a black man's triumph over adversity. Carter now makes his living delivering that message to groups around the United States and Canada. Last month, he shared his story with an auditorium full of high school students in the Toronto suburbs.
Dare to dream, brothers and sisters. Dare to dream. You see, whatever we can dream in our mind, whatever we can think of, and then act upon, can be achieved. My standing here today is living proof of that.
Reuben Carter also runs the Association in Defense of the Wrongfully Convicted, which has so far managed to help several Canadians escape the fate that he endured. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.